last few years, I have found a great deal of comfort and companionship reading Buddhist writers. Sharon Salzberg is one of my favorites. She talks about this. The degree of love we manifest determines the degree of spaciousness and freedom we can bring to life's events. She says, imagine taking a very small glass of water and putting into it a teaspoon of salt. Because of the small size of the container, the teaspoon of salt is going to have a big effect on the water. However, if you approach a much larger body of water, such as a lake, and put in the same teaspoonful of salt, it will not have the same intensity of impact because of the vastness and openness of the vessel receiving it. Even when the salt remains the same, the spaciousness of the vessel receiving it changes everything. We spend a lot of our lives looking for a feeling of safety or protection. We try to alter the amount of salt that comes our way. Ironically, the salt is the very thing we cannot do anything about, as life changes and offers us repeated ups and downs. Our true work is to create a container so immense that any amount of salt, even a truckload, can come into it without our affecting our capacity to receive it. Passages, expansions, diminishments. It's no secret that all the world around us is a strange and amazing place for many of us. We simply can't seem to get a grasp on it. The minute we think we've got hold of it, it slips away and we don't know what to do. Either we clutch tightly and try to go backward, or for any number of reasons we're impelled to go forward into that space of what Salzberg calls expansion. For some of us, these are big moments. Some of us, they're little. Sometimes they happen on and off through short periods of time. Sometimes the contraction and expansion is a part of a long process that may go on for years, as, for example, in a recovery program. And I mean, if we look at it, all of us in this room are recovering from something. That's just how it is. So we're looking, most of us, to try to find a more expansive vision. We're looking for this lake that's a huge, vast body of water so that when the salt of life touches us and seasons us, we're ready to receive it and ready to grow. But it's not an easy thing because we don't live in a culture that, in general, encourages that kind of thinking. We live in a culture that diminishes us with its judgments and its difficulties. When Sam suggested that I think about the idea of Janus, the god of passages, I thought, well, that's interesting. So I went home and did some reading about Janus, the Roman god of passageways and transitions, and a god to whom armies sacrificed before going into battle. And I looked at the image, and it's on the front cover of the bulletin, and it's the two-headed god, the one that looks both ways. Janus is watching things as they happen, and he's watching things as they go away. And I thought to myself, well, isn't that interesting? But I looked at the heads, and I thought for a while, and I said, you know, this isn't really comforting because these two heads are frozen. They can't turn. They can't move their eyes. And the most frightening part of it was they can't look down. They can't look at the threshold that's beneath them where a lot of us live. We might live in one room, one side of the door for a while, and another side of the door for a while, but at some point or another, we're going to be brought to the middle of this place where the Roman gods can't see us. I was influenced years ago by an anthropology teacher at the University of Virginia named Victor Turner. And Victor's main theme over and over again was this notion of the threshold. which he used the Latin word, the limen, the place where people go when they're stuck. They can't go in either room, in either direction. Some of us live on the threshold. We spend our whole life there. But no one's ever identified that because Janus sees only this side and this side. He's absolutely blind to what's underneath him. Do you follow? Okay. Too much time spent teaching, you know? Do you follow? Do you want me to draw this on a board? Well, I mean, at least I have this moment of security realizing that I'm in Tom's robe, and I don't have to worry about whether you can see that the dog rubbed against my pants. And I don't know whether my zipper's down, and I don't care. The world of Janus, the two-headed god, he can't look down. His vision is always one of seeming to be worried about losing something in the other ways, always worried about controlling something. Remember, these are fixed positions. Janus is the god of effort. He's the god of stress, the god of the bottom line. Janus is the two-headed god that's always worried about winning and losing. He's the god of increased complication in our culture. He looks back on my failures and reminds me that there's something called guilt. Janus knows all the rules, and he knows all the punishments. Janus says things like this: you know, if you touch that, it's a mortal sin, and you'll burn in hell forever. Oh, the Catholics like that. Or, for example, somebody in a far distant city whom I've never met pushed a computer key one day, and I lost my job. We've heard that one. And Janus's line for that is, now, don't take this personally. Another one. Your child just flunked the SOLs, and probably she'll never be successful in school. We don't know what to do with her. Another one, I'll love you in the morning. Let it settle. You'll never be as good as your brother. He's so smart, and he's so tall, and you're fat, pudgy, not really very bright. And my favorite line of Janus that we've been hearing for years is, we're going to stay the course. Then walk by a magazine stand. I did this yesterday. I walked by a magazine stand to see if Janus was speaking to me. Look at what we are invited to think about in terms of ourselves. Time to lose that extra 10 pounds. You don't look good in purple. Get six-pack abs. Always the magazines, everything around us in some way is trying to find some way to diminish us. Not to empty us in a good way, but to empty us in a way where we examine our life and see that who we are, what we are, is not enough. And that every morning we ought to get up and look at somebody else to find out if it's okay to be who we are. And many of us came through religious backgrounds that invited us to experience just exactly that kind of diminished life. What I found over the years is that my God was not Janus. My God had many names. And that the name could change, and that it didn't have to be the same name all the time. And that as I experienced life and as I experienced my own transition and expansion of boundaries, the things that I read and heard from others and from God, the God of my understanding, was be aware. We love you just the way you are. Live simply so that others may simply live. Let it go. Stay awake to what's happening to you. None of what's going on is really about you. Come unto me, all who are burdened, and I will give you rest. The God of many names doesn't necessarily stand in pulpits like this and talk. The God of many names is an awareness that we carry within ourselves and need to be reminded of all the time that life is much bigger than who we are. That life has possibilities and ways of expanding beyond anything we can ever know. And in order to remember that, it's helpful to be reminded and to be in a community that is always about expanding boundaries, always about seeking new and more luminous a vision. It's something that shines. It's something that is really always unnameable. It's emotion that comes and sweeps through us, and suddenly we are different from what we were. And belonging in a community where we can share that is, for me, a very, very valuable thing. Again, Victor Turner's notion was that the encounter with the sacred, the encounter with the divine, the encounter with that which is much larger than we can ever imagine, that which waits to embrace us beyond our known limits, may happen at any given moment. It may happen in a book, piece of poetry, a piece of music. Let me get a drink of water. Last October, for those of you who don't know, this is my hobby. I'm a musician. All this is a hobby. I was honored to be a part of the National Folk Festival in Richmond, and it was a marvelous experience for me. But I shared a stage manager and general performance area with a band, a jazz band from New Orleans called Treme, T-R-E-M-E. It's the name of a neighborhood that was absolutely and utterly devastated in Katrina. So anyway, I'd never met these people, and we were sort of a few feet apart. I had played, and I was done, and I was talking to Bob Lentz, who's a friend of mine, who's another musician, and we see each other periodically. We were just, you know, running our mouths and talking. All of a sudden, this incredible brass band music started to sort of be off in the edge of my life over here. And, I mean, I play Dixieland. Some of you have heard me, and I love that kind of music. But this music had a power that I just simply couldn't describe. And I nudged Lentz, and I said, "What is that?" He says, "I don't know." And we sat and listened to, I can't remember the piece, but I was aware that the music was developing something that was shining and glowing and magnificent for me. And before I knew it, I was sitting there, and tears were rolling down my face. It's 10 o'clock at night. I don't know what's going on, you know. And I look over at Lentz, same thing. There was something so real about this band music. And I've heard everything, you know. This stuff doesn't get to me. And this stuff did. Well, I had lunch with them the next day. And I said, "What is it about you people? How do you do that?" Well, of course, they'd have no idea how they do it. They're old black people, and they play funerals in New Orleans. And they lost everything in Katrina. Their instruments, their homes, one of them lost a grandchild. But there's something about their music and the way they give themselves to that moment that lifts them and everybody around them to a place of such expansion and light that it's unmistakable. They play in a place called Donna's Bar and Grill on Friday nights in New Orleans. They've been playing there for years. And right before they'd come to Richmond, they had won a huge award up in D.C. for their magnificent work over the years. They were amazing. We shared performance space the next day, and there's the band, but there's also Miss Leela. Miss Leela is a marvelous African-American woman who has a banner across here, and she leads the parades, and she has a parasol. And when the parasol goes up, look out. It's time. It's time. And she's shaking her hips, and she comes off the stage into this expand. It was just time. They said it's time for a parade. And off she went. Parasol went up, she's shaking her hips, and all of these fuzzy, screaming white people in Richmond just went nuts! And they were marching in the dark, following the light. And so, transitions for me are movements into that kind of an experience. To be with those kinds of people who know what it means to die and to rise again. To realize that life and death are all part of a big, great peace. And that the great expanse of it all, the great wonder of it all, is that all of it is held in life. And that's what... You can't leave life, one of them told me. You can't leave it. His name is Uncle Baptiste. You can't leave life. It's always here. No matter what happens to you, you are always in life. I wish there were more bands like that in my life. Maybe there will be someday. I found this little quote. If we meet this world unprotected, our heart gets broken over and over and over. This is actually a gift. Let the world touch you. Let it shatter you. Let it shatter you open. And it will. And here you are. And all of a sudden, you're shining. After our heart is broken 1,000 times, and all of the contents are emptied out, all that's left is the shining. Blessed be.